I know less about what's presently going on with school meals and gardens than everyone here, I'm sure, and so I don't really have much to offer you except a long history of deploring the American food system and a lot of enthusiasm about getting decent food into schools and getting gardens into schools and getting kids growing food and so forth. And I was saying to someone the other day, the trouble is that as a woman who had a mother who actually boiled rice, I realized I was in trouble when I started teaching students for whom boiled rice was something like their mother used to make. And then when I discovered that minute rice was something that their grandmothers used to make, I knew I'd been teaching too long. Because it's like coming into the classroom and talking about the war, which I used to do when I meant War II, which nobody knew. So I'm going to offer you a bit of history from the time before many of you were out of diapers, just so you'll appreciate what an amazing period you're living in. A time when many schools across the U.S. have gardens sponsored by their administrators and participated in enthusiastically by the teachers. A time when the Journal of the American Dietetic Association, folks, has a green cover that says nutrition education through school gardens, although there's only one article inside about that, but nevertheless, it's really a change. When I remember that when we first talked about changing the name of the Society for Nutrition Education to the Society for Food and Nutrition Education, and one of my own students stood up and said, nutritionists don't want to have anything to do with food. We live now in a time when a chef actually has an important role in the school food service in New York City. And the idea that school lunches might actually be healthy and delicious and freshly cooked and based on foods available regionally, some of them from the school's own garden, has moved from being the notion of sort of some left-wing romantic to being sort of the mainstream, which is wonderful. We haven't gotten there, but we're moving in the right direction. And that kind of thing is part of the planning of many schools across the country. So here's the history. In 1975, see, I told you it was going to be a long time ago, when I became, to my own shocked surprise, the chair of the department at Teachers College, the nutrition education department, it wasn't a department, it was a program, actually. I found myself almost immediately in a controversy about school lunch. Two people who shall temporarily remain nameless, one of them working for me, the other one then a student, had done some research on meals in New York City, the New York City school food program. They produced a report about what they found and testified before Senator George McGovern's Hunger Committee, which was investigating, quote, food quality in federal food programs. Attention to what these two instigators were up to. Since as a brand new chair, I had lots of things on my mind, so I couldn't be monitoring everybody. Their report was formally named the Food Fiasco. We tend to like really flashy titles at Teachers College. Informally, it was called the Liquori Ravitch Report. Oh, I'm sorry. Its essential message was that the little lunches called meal packs that were served in the New York City school system failed to meet federal standards. The report was not at all well received by the school lunch folks or by the company that prepared the little lunches. It was called Mass Feeding Corporation, which I think is just... They had a formal reply prepared denying that the meals were substandard and saying that the methods were inaccurate. As a friend of mine used to say about research, she said the only time they attack your research is when you find out something important. The controversy even made it into the New York Times, which of course brought it to the attention of the administrators here and my colleagues and the dean, and so I immediately realized that I should be paying more attention. But it also taught me that I should pay more attention to school lunch, and so when I did, I was appalled by what I saw. As it happened, I was speaking at that time to a group in Washington, my maiden voyage into this group, which was a very distinguished group of people, and I was this brand new administrator. And it's called, I have to read this because I've never gotten, I hope they don't still call it that, the annual meeting of the Association of State and Territorial Public Health Nutrition Directors and Joint Symposium of the ASTPHND and Association of Graduate Faculties in Public Health Nutrition. Now that doesn't leave you much room on the program. I was there as the new kid on the block, and I was quite nervous talking to this tradition-bound organization, but I could not control my own radicalism. And my excuse for standing here this morning is that I was able to find a copy of what I'd said 30 years ago. And Tony told me it was worth repeating. So I'm going to read you some of it. I said that as a new administrator, I was trying to decide what it was we needed to teach students to get them ready for the future. And then I mentioned that my colleague Jan Dodds and I had recently discovered that in 25 of the schools in Washington Heights, children were being served pre-plated meals shipped frozen from California. And then I went on. Now, at some point in time, someone's view of the future involved the possibility of serving from California lunches on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. That view involved a disastrous misunderstanding of the way the world was going and about the inevitable limits to energy and raw materials. Envision, if you can, the waste involved in mining, refining, and shaping those aluminum trays, heating and then cooking the food, freezing those thousands of meals and keeping them frozen across 2,000 miles, transporting them by truck or train at the cost of coal or diesel fuel to some central storage point in the metropolitan area, from which a truck, using more fossil fuel, picks them up and transports them to the schools, where they are reheated, served, and thrown away half-eaten because the Puerto Rican children in Washington Heights don't really like the food the people in California have prepared for them. It is our view of the future, I went on, that this is the logical endpoint of an irrational food delivery system. It is our view of the future that the concern of all professionals in the field of nutrition must expand to include the entirety of this vast and often irrational food production and distribution system. It is our view that the policies of the last 20 years, which have resulted in an increasing centralization of food production and processing in the name of economic efficiency, will succumb to the increasing recognition that such a system is energetically, ecologically, and socially insane. In a destitute city, surrounded by, it was destitute 20 years ago, folks, 30 years ago, surrounded by increasingly hard-pressed farmers, it is not rational that the produce required for school food programs should be imported from California, nor is it rational that the jobs produced by the handling and preparation of such food should be exported to California. I believe that future nutrition professionals must be sufficiently sophisticated about energetic, economic, political, social, agricultural, and marketing realities that they could attack such absurdities knowledgeably and with an understanding of that, the magnitude of their implications. So that's what I was saying 30 years ago. Standing here 30 years later, I think our nutrition program managed in some ways to turn out nutrition professionals who could do what I was describing, though we can hardly take credit for the amazing things that have happened in the last 30 years. Indeed, where gardens and schools were concerned, in those early days, we experienced nothing but failure. When there was briefly in the 70s small but real funding for nutrition education in the schools, all sorts of innovations broke out across the country. And we used to say here that anything that was going on anywhere in the country was also happening somewhere in this city, which was true. I mean, the number of innovations and ideas that were fermenting were amazing. But there were not, to my best of my recollection, or that of Peggy Ravitch, now Peggy Ravitch Zamor, who was one of the notorious writers of that report. She says she can't remember that either, and she was very busy around the city. There were no school gardens. There were some community gardens in the cities in those days, but gardening in those macadam schoolyards didn't really seem imaginable when we began looking at the problem. I had working for me someone who was a master at getting things done. That was Peggy. And we couldn't even get a garden on the roof of Teachers College right next here, even though we had a whole load of compost dumped in the courtyard. And then they turned us down. So it seems amazing to me where things have come in the last 30 years. Now even in Manhattan, there are places where school gardens flourish thanks to the efforts of neighborhoods, parents, and schools. 30 years may seem a very long time to some of you, since it's occupied so much of your lives to date. But the simple fact is that many things have gotten much worse in 30 years. I'll spare you by not giving you a list this morning. You probably know what they are. Nothing guaranteed that school lunch would really change for the better, however much we wanted it to, and however hard some of you worked to make it happen. Nothing guaranteed that the skepticism or even hostility to the idea of school gardens that first met those adventurous souls who tried to introduce children to growing would give way to actual enthusiasm for what could be learned and how diets might be changed when children grow food in the schoolyards or nearby lots. In light of the fact that success is never guaranteed, you should feel wonderful about the fact that we have reached the place where we haven't yet reached the place we want to get to, we're moving at least in the right direction, and the amount of change that's taken place in the last three decades, nothing short of miraculous. In my darker moments, when it seemed to me that this overwrought and wasteful and ecologically absurd food system we inherited would never change unless it was preceded by total economic and ecological collapse, I have suggested that perhaps the only way we could get people to demand real food, to change their diet so as to support local farmers and keep agriculture alive in the U.S., was to scare them to death. Tell them of the hazards of depending on for our food on countries 2,000 miles away who hate us. And tell them, alarm them with the frequency with which meat and even spinach turn out to be contaminated before it reaches their tables. A drive up of energy prices, I thought, might help, since it would make food imported from China too expensive. But to make people willing to rethink how they actually ate would require something stronger, because we had all been so poorly taught about what a realistic way was to eat here in the Northeast. But now it seems to me that people like all of you here today are pointing to another way in which we might get to a rational food system. We can corrupt children, as Kurt Vonnegut once said, with a little kindness. We can corrupt children with the delights and deliciousness of eating real food by letting them learn how to eat food from the garden instead of from the supermarket of a fast food eatery, by letting them eat fresh local food in the lunchroom. We might raise a generation of eaters who won't have to be scared into eating locally. They will grow up sharing my suspicion of strange and distant foods about whose production they know nothing. They will understand how food grows, what it takes to grow it, and how important farmers are to us all. That is surely what we have to hope for, and I thank you all for being part of such a hopeful movement.